I thought it was insane. I was already friends with Marion Seldes, who was a mentor to me. And she said, I want to tell you, you have to do it, but I also don't know how you could do this.
And then he died 5 months later. Exactly.
And then he died. So then it became a guilt. It was a guilt trip. I was like, I let him down. But how do I do this? And then I finally thought I knew how to do it or had what it took to do it and moved to New York and started knocking on the doors.
So then 1982, you went down there and for 5 days, he talked to you and you took copious notes.
Yes. Yes. I didn't know it was going to be 5 days. I thought it was going to be a lunch. So there I am. I meet him in Jackson Square. We go to the Court of Two Sisters restaurant. We start talking. Dusk approaches. He takes me to St. Louis Cathedral. We pray. He buys me a rosary. And I'm walking out of the cathedral thinking this is goodbye. And instead, he said, I'll meet you in the morning. Okay. So I drove back to Baton Rouge and then went back to New Orleans the next day.
How long a trip?
It's about 80 miles. So you can do it in about an hour. And that went on. The last 2 days were continual. There was no sleep. I didn't leave to drive to Baton Rouge. I had youth. He had cocaine. We stayed awake. There was an urgency in him. And I thought, there I was, 20 years old, a nobody. And here he was, Tennessee Williams. He was selling the idea. You know, normally you would think it'd be the exact opposite. I'd be 20 going, please read my work. Please help me. You know, I'll do anything. And instead it was, let me tell you how this would be. And it would be wonderful for you and material. I could bring no judgments because I didn't know anything.
Why you? I mean.
Well, I wasn't fannish, which he liked. We also were both very good at imitations. And we would sit at tables and in hotel rooms. And he also was amazed by the fact that I was 20 years old and knew everyone he mentioned, which impresses me now that I'm old. And I can mention the most obscure character actress. And he goes, oh, I love her. And you're taken aback. So he was comfortable with me because I knew these people, admired them, could talk about them. I knew his work. And I was interested in talking to him about his work, not what was Elizabeth Taylor really like. I mean, that eventually came out, but it wasn't what I opened with. And I wasn't asking him for money or can I get the name of an agent? I was asking him to tell me what it was all about. And no one was doing that.
But you took copious notes. You did not have a tape recorder. No. Deliberately.
Well, not deliberately. Didn't have a tape recorder. I mean, I didn't go there as a reporter. I went there as a rube and a student, and I had my blue examination booklets from college, you know, in which you took, you know, your examinations. But I have to say, apropos tape recorders, I now have to use them because I'm 53 and I don't have that memory that I used to have. And I also can't take notes as quickly. And I always had an invented shorthand. I never learned, you know, Greg shorthand. But I don't like tape recorders. It's better now with the digital tape recorders. But when I came to New York in 89, I had an old-fashioned tape recorder with cassette tapes, and we always would stare at the tape recorder, and I'd be worried about it. And I can't tell you how many times I would have to – I remember Mildred Natwick interviewing her, and all of a sudden, from the corner of my eye, I saw the tape unspooling out of the machine. So everything was lost. So I had to go back. So I just thought, you know what? Here's how you get great quotes, and here's how there's great authenticity and veracity. You take copious notes, you run home, you type everything up, and you send it to them. That's what I did. Now, I told that to Carl Bernstein once, and his head exploded. And I had to explain to him, I'm not a political reporter. I would never give that courtesy to Hillary Clinton. Like, well, no, I didn't mean it when I said we should bomb Iran. You know, no, you went on, no, you said that, it stays. These were people telling me very, very personal things. And I have to say, no one ever cut anything. Instead, whether it was Marlon Brando or Geraldine Page or Katharine Hepburn, they would read it and go, I got your notes, but I want to add to this. So then they got better. So a question I get a lot of times on my blog and my Facebook page is, how do you get such good quotes? That's how. There's a trust that builds up.
James Grissom, let's go back a little bit. You said you knew Marion Seldes, the actress. How did you meet her and how did she become your mentor? Because without her, this book
never happened. It would never have happened without her. I mean, she's the engine and the angel of that book. When I was in high school in Baton Rouge, I was an actor, and I thought I was going to be an actor. There was a drama club, and every Thanksgiving, the drama club came to New York for a week and saw about 7 or 8 shows. In November of 1978, November 20th of 1978, we saw Death Trap, the Ira Levin mystery that was at the Music Box Theater. Marion was in it, and in the playbill, it said that Marion had written her autobiography called The Bright Lights. I ran to Marlboro Books at the intermission of Death Trap, bought the book, and we all waited backstage, as we did everywhere, to get autographs and talk to the actors. Marion signed my book, and I told her I'd like to be an actor, and for reasons I will never know, it was just the kindness of that woman. She said, "Let's talk. When are you free?" And I said, "Well, I'm seeing Annie tomorrow night, and I've already seen it." And she said, "Well, you know, I die in the first act." So I said, "Well, then fine. I'll leave Annie at intermission. I'll come to Death Trap and we'll talk." And I did. And she helped me. I had already missed, I forget what they're called. They're called league auditions, where you audition for certain schools. Oh, yeah. I had missed the deadline. She finagled things with Margot Harley and got me in to an audition for Juilliard. But she said, "Let's be friends," which I'll never forget. And read everything I wrote. It soon became clear that I didn't want to be an actor enough. She said, "But you're a brilliant writer. Why? And you have a gift, such as it is, for walking up to people and getting from them exactly what you need. You did it with me. So write to the writer or writers who mean the most to you." And that's how I wrote the letter to Tennessee Williams. In my ignorance, I wrote it care of Audrey Wood, whom he'd fired. But he was still within the same agency, and they were dutiful and got it to, I guess, Bill Barnes at that time. And Tennessee answered it 6 months later, I think, by calling my parents home in Baton Rouge. When we were in New Orleans and he was saying, "Here are the people I want you to reach out to," I was taking the notes down on a menu. And when he said Marion Seldes, I said, "Oh, I know her." And he was like, "How do you know her? You're this 20-year-old rube." I mean, and I told him that story. And that night from his hotel room, he called Marion in New York and did a reference check on me. And then, of course, she called me and said, "What on earth is going on?" So she really made it all possible. And then when I got to New York, I said, "I don't know how to get in touch with John Gielgud or Irene Wirth or Alec Guinness." She arranged all those. So, yeah, she was the soul of my life.
James Grissom, I want to fast forward several years because, you know, I look at the people that you spoke with, Seldes, Joe Van Fleet, Marlon Brando, Ilya Kazan, Kim Stanley, Kate Hepburn, Kim Hunter, Eva LaGallien, Maureen Stapleton. I'm leaving out the live ones here. So we're talking about 30 years between the time that you met Tennessee Williams and began this tour of actresses, directors, and actors. Mm-hmm. As it grew, did you know it was going to be a book? What were you thinking?
I wanted it to be a book. I hoped it would be a book. I didn't know how to make it into a book. I actually started the journey about 7 years after Tennessee died. I moved on St. Patrick's Day of 89 and had lunch with Marion Seldes, and she pulled out all the notes, the letters I'd been sending her, and said, "This is a book."
How many of those little blue books did you have?
I don't even remember. I think 4 or 5, and then we moved to legal pads. I remember being in Antoine's, and I had no more paper, and they gave me this wonderful linen paper that they used to print their menus. So the notes for the book are a hodgepodge of papers. Notebook paper, typing paper, backs of menus, shirt boards, whatever. And then I would go and type it up. An IBM Selectric, so which I still have the typewriter. I don't think it works. And then later went into computer form. It has gone through all sorts of phases. Also, what happened when I started writing this book, when I tell this to certain audiences, their eyes glaze over like I'm from the Pleistocene era. There was no internet. I didn't have a computer. I had an IBM Selectric. I would have to type letters, post them. And then if it was the wrong address for, say, Katharine Hepburn or whatever, it was returned to me. It was very arduous, and I had to make a living. And so I would work, and I'd get frustrated, and I'd give up. Marion was very helpful in that way because she would cut through all of that and say, "I'm just going to call them." And then my phone would ring, and it would be Carrie Nye or Katharine Hepburn or someone like that. Barbara Baxley was helpful in getting me to Joe Van Fleet, who didn't talk to anybody and was very reclusive and angry. It was really because I didn't know how to write the book. By not knowing how to write the book, I meant, all right, I have these great interviews. What do I do with them? And what I did, and my editor, Victoria Wilson, here at Knopf, was really great because she said, you have to write it as Tennessee presented it to you, which was odd. But I think it's a gift that people can read this book and get some kind of feeling of what it must be like to walk around the French Quarter with Tennessee and all these disjointed thoughts, which he compared to leaves in the wind. And I kept trying to impose a narrative order on it. And it was cleaned up, but it was antiseptic. It didn't sound legitimate because anyone who knew Tennessee, even from talk show appearances, would say, this is too orderly and too neat. And I would try to present the women like types of women, like the soul searchers, you know, and that would be like Julie Harris, Lois Smith, Mildred Natwick. And I go, no, this is not how Tennessee told it to me. There was some kind of emotional sense to how Tennessee told me these stories and why these women mattered to him. I have to follow what he gave me. And then it started to fall into place. Then it was too long. It was almost 1,000 pages. And I love it. If you ever get a chance to meet Victoria Wilson, you should. She is wonderfully laconic and terse. And she called me when I turned in the manuscript, which is 900 and something pages. And she said, hi, I want to tell you, this book borders on greatness. Thank you. You're going to have to cut it. I don't publish Russian novels. So a lot of what I had to cut from the book, what I call the detritus of the fog, is on my blog. She was right. She said, focus it on those women. And while there are great quotes from Kazan and Arthur Penn and all these other people about life and the theater and Marilyn Monroe and what matters and why the theater is no good anymore, it fogs up the book, for lack of a better word.
You're listening to an interview with James Grissom, whose book is titled Follies of God, Tennessee Williams and the Women of the Fog. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves.
Yes, and this has been an excerpt from a Book Waves program. If you'd like to hear the entire interview, go to bookwaves.com.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Thursday, December 17th, 2015. I'm John Shuck. The National Weather Service says heavy rain is expected across the Portland area through tonight. The region could expect to get between 1 and 3 inches of rain throughout the day. A flood watch is in effect for all of the Willamette Valley. Portland's Bureau of Transportation is warning people that the heavy rain could cause hazardous traveling conditions like wet and slippery roads and standing water. City officials said that anyone disobeying road closure signs could face fines of up to $1,000. The Confederate tribes of Warm Springs could be among the first tribes in the country to sell marijuana. Members of the tribes will vote today whether or not to grow and process marijuana on the reservation and sell it in tribal-owned stores in Portland and in other cities in Oregon. The proposal would not change the law on the reservation, where marijuana remains illegal. There will be no gun-toting teachers at Lowell Charter School in Lowell, Oregon. Proposals to remove the ban on firearms and allow for armed teachers have been tabled. The Mountain View Academy School Board put the brakes on the gun proposal on Tuesday. The Lowell Charter School is housed in one of the district's elementary schools and therefore must follow Lowell School District policies. The director of the charter school, Lori Caldwell, had introduced the subject in November after the Umpqua Community College shooting. The Seattle School Board voted last month to have a later start time for all of its high schools and most middle schools. Next year, school will begin at 8:45. More school districts across the country are moving to later start times following the advice of scientists who have shown that starting school before 8 a.m. results in adverse health effects and a decrease in performance. According to the American Academy of Pediatricians, later start times for students will improve academic success, attendance, mental health, and cut sleep-related car accidents. In international news, nearly two-thirds of Palestinians anticipate an armed uprising. According to the results of a poll published Monday by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey, 66% of Palestinians surveyed believe an armed uprising will have greater potential to achieve their goal than peace talks with Israel. This is the first time since prior to the Second Intifada in 2000 that a majority of Palestinians believe the intensified violence will lead to a full-scale intifada. That's all for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, December 17th, 2015. Tune in every weekday at 5 for more local, national, and international news produced by volunteer reporters in our Portland studios. For KBOO News, I'm John Shuck. Be well.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And now it's time for the Shocks of Sheba. Hey, oh, what a blessing sound. Oh, what a blessing sound. Listen. What a blessing sound. What a blessing sound.